Hello and welcome to the Sandeep Roy Show on Express Audio.
The Sandeep Roy Show.
In a democracy, we are told the voter is king. And in the marketplace, we are told the customer is king. And on the face of it, it feels like that. We, after all, have the choice to vote for candidate A or B, or buy product C instead of D. But in reality, both government and market have assumed enormous power over our lives and choices. New laws and regulations have made it seem that the government is trying to bring civil society organizations to heel, though the government insists it's just trying to instill transparency and accountability. Mega transnational corporations rule our lives in ways we don't even fathom. And the citizen appears puny against such giant forces. Forces that, ironically, have derived their power from the citizen. Rohini Nilekani has been active in the civil society sector for many years as a philanthropist and founding member of various organizations. A collection of essays on the topic is Samaj Sarkar Bazaar, A Citizen's First Approach. Rohini Nilekani, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Sandeep.
You write in this book something that many people will relate to, which is we were always told wealth is not what you aspire to. You aspire to high thinking. When you came into great wealth after selling Infosys shares, how difficult was it for you to publicly say, I'm wealthy?
Yeah, Sandeep, it really was difficult for me. I don't want our audiences to get it wrong. You know, look at that poor little rich girl complaining about being wealthy. Okay, it sounds terrible, but that's not what I mean. I mean that as we grew up in a middle-class urban family, there was wealth around us in Mumbai, remember? But in our family, we were by no means badly off. We were middle-class. But the stories in the family, the sort of culture that was impressed upon us was that wealth is not what makes you. And then in those days, remember, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. In India too, wealth was not something that you aspired to. You aspired to a different idea of the nation. We didn't first say, oh, everyone in India should be prosperous. We first said, everyone in India should be included, right? We have to still make this country. We have to build this country. We have to bring its people together, that sort of thing. So in those days, wealth was what I guess the industrial families had, or the erstwhile Maharajas, not normal people. And Infosys was a real experiment in that sense, right? A bunch of professionals coming together, determined to succeed. But the first thing even on their minds were not, oh, let's set up Infosys and become billionaires. First thing on their minds also was, let's set up a company. And they say it in their motto about being powered by, driven by values or powered by values, and with a strive for excellence. No, so again, just to put it in context, why I was so uncomfortable being wealthy, I was also a bit of a activist. All of us were a little bit on the left. And so when I myself came into so much wealth, it really took me years to deal with the fact that now I was on the so-called other side. I rebelled a bit. I couldn't understand what to do with it, because it's not like we were brought up to say, why don't you just shop till you drop and have a great time? What's the big deal? We couldn't do that somehow. So that wealth had to have some purpose and meaning. So it took some time, but then somewhere the penny dropped. Certainly, Nandan had something to do with it, saying, you know, accept it and make something of it. So then it, rather than seeing it as something strange, it became more of a joyful responsibility to learn how to use that wealth. Of course, for ourselves too, but also think of it as something you could do more with in the societal domain.
I understand that this must have been a sort of a gradual process for you, but does anything stick out as a moments when you realize that in fact, it's okay. This is not unethical. This is not like the Bollywood scenario of, look, oh, if you have great wealth, then, you know, you must be engaged in immense corruption.
Yeah, I do remember that in those days. But luckily, this happened now in the early 2000s, by which time India had liberalized, and a decade of liberalization had changed public attitudes also towards the creation of wealth. There's also a shift in the mindset, I feel, that wealth creation is what India needs now. And because Infosys was always driven by a very strong core of ethics, the wealth that had come to us was perfectly legal, perfectly transparent, perfectly, hopefully, ethically made wealth, right? So that was not the issue. So that certainly helped. Both the fact that liberalization, in any case, had made that wealth possible, and there's a public shift in the mental model of what India should be doing now. And then because I used to travel a lot in those days with Nandan as well, and just to learn, you know, we were able to travel abroad. We had already spent a lot of time in the US, but after we became wealthy, then I got to go to places like Davos, where all the world's elite were there, and they didn't think much about, certainly this problem was not on their minds. But I also then got to meet a lot more philanthropists around the world, because that's whom I was drawn to, and began to see more and more what an opportunity this could bring for my work.
But you say that philanthropist was a descriptor that did not sit so well with me in the early days. Why?
You know, this whole idea of philanthropy, remember, is a bit new. Okay, people used to do good old-fashioned charity because humans care for humans. And if you had more money, you did more charity. And if you had less money, you did less charity. And I think that's the highest sort of human attribute, right? Empathy. So then as foundations began to be born and wealthy people started to become so wealthy that, as they said, that if you have a Ferrari, you better have a foundation too. This whole new thing which the media celebrated about philanthropy came into being just about 30 or 40 years ago. And that kind of thing, which later Matthew Bishop even called philanthrocapitalism, right, which sat even more uneasily with me. And I used to tell him so it's not, I'm not saying something that he doesn't know. So that's what I meant, that I was a little uneasy that philanthropy was something too big a word. And even underlying that, as even Martin Luther King said, that when we say, okay, philanthropy does good, we mustn't forget why philanthropy comes into existence, because it always reminds you that there is so much inequality, right? So that was the discomfort. But now I've settled down to it.
But would you agree, since you talked about charity, that when people argue that rich Indians, and there are a lot of rich Indians right now, might be charitable, but not enough of them are philanthropists?
Yeah, I think people are beginning to change. Okay, in the sense that, yes, people still do charity, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. But the kind of, I guess, the axiomatic idea is that philanthropy is somehow smarter, or philanthropy is more strategic. Because hopefully, if you have so much money and you're committed to certain causes, then you're going to go beyond just feeding the poor and clothing the naked, as they used to say in the old days, and say, why are so many people needing the food and clothes in the first place? And that's what you use the philanthropy for, to do the institution building, the leadership building, the agency formation, or rediscovery rather than formation. And I think that's what starts to separate, in today's lexicon, philanthropy from charity. And I believe a lot more Indian wealthy are seeing that and want to do that.
So you would be in somewhat disagreement when, you know, when, for example, you and your husband signed the giving pledge, where people pledged to give away 50% of their wealth in their lifetimes. Immediately, there were lots of articles about why are so few wealthy Indians signing the giving pledge. Are they afraid that if you sign the giving pledge, it'll draw the attention of the tax man immediately? But you seem to be suggesting that actually that's changing quite a bit.
I do think it's changing quite a bit. Unfortunately, there are very, very few. I think only 4 people who have signed, who live in India, who have signed the giving pledge. I wish more would sign, because it's not like the giving pledge community is holding a gun to your head. It's just a public commitment to giving away 50% of your wealth, which is not even much considering how much people have now. The top 2,000 people in India or so. I mean, the kind of money you have, 7-8 generations will sit happily with just what they have now. So there is really no insecurity or fear left. So I wish more would sign. Maybe they still don't see the need to. Then maybe we need an Indian version of it or something. Suppose it's culturally not a fit, but we do need something like that. However, there are a lot of new things emerging where philanthropists in India are coming together under Dasra does something, Living My Promise does something. So there are Indian versions of that emerging. But I think there's always scope for the Indian wealthy to give forward much more.
How did you, well, I assume it was a family decision, decide to sign the giving pledge? You know, what prompted it?
It took us a while because, again, there's a cultural thing. No, in India, you don't really give sign pledges and make yourself look really good in the headline saying, look at me, I signed a giving pledge, right? Yeah. So that was our first hesitation. And then, you know, the international community of the wealthy, right? We didn't really hobnob with them. So we had those fears, but then we talked it through. And I felt especially, and Nandan certainly agreed, that it is time for us to give up the old notion that the left hand should not know what the right hand does in charity. The time now is to signal loud and clear that wealth, and especially such wealth, has a public responsibility. And we thought this was one way of signaling it. And secondly, that it would give us a chance to learn how other ultra-high net worth individuals, what are they doing? So we are hoping to join this global learning community. And I must say, it is a global learning community, trying to learn from each other. The 250 odd people who have signed the global giving pledge. Certainly, we meet once in a year at least, and there is a lot of learning and sharing. So I think in hindsight, we did make the right decision.
How have your peers in India taken it? Have they had conversations with you about it, expressed interest?
You know, we tried when Bill Gates used to come here, one of the things on the agenda was to increase Indian philanthropy. So we had something called the India Philanthropy Initiative, where I think it did shift the needle a little bit. Azim Premji was very much part of hosting some of those things. It did shift the needle a little bit, but possibly not enough. And certainly since more people have not signed the giving pledge yet, well, we have to see what happens.
Now, I'm going to take you back a little bit to when you started getting involved with civil service organizations. And in your book, you talk about one of the first groups you did, which was Nagarik. And you said it was a failure and a steep learning curve. Can you talk about why now, with hindsight, why it failed and what you hoped it would do?
So we started Nagarik, a few like-minded citizens. I got a few people together because I was very moved, as I say in the book, by the death of close friends in a very senseless car crash. And India remains one of the worst countries in the world to be on the road. We have the maximum number of deaths even today on our roads. So we were moved to do something to make roads safer. But I think at that time, since for many of us, it was the first time we were trying to do something like this together. And I guess everyone had day jobs. We didn't know quite how to do it. And it was perhaps something that we were more interested in doing than society was ready for at that time. So it was morally undeniable to say our road should be safer. But I don't think we took the citizens with us enough to make it a broad-based movement or to sustain the energy or to get the next level of people into the organization, etc. So we tried a few things, interesting things, but eventually ineffective things, I think. And in a few years, in humility, we sort of shut the effort down. But I'm sure each one of us learned a lot on the way that, first of all, what cause you take up has to resonate with the public. Secondly, how you organize yourself has to be very clear. You need to pull in all kinds of resources and you need to really hang in there for a very long time before change can be seen. So it was good that in the first institution that I co-founded, we learned a few quick, hard lessons, hopefully without harming anybody in the process, which is very important, actually. Because in the civil society sector, we can't glorify failure. In the market space, they like to almost glorify failure, like fail fast and all that. Because after you fail, there may still be somebody else to support you in your next venture. But in the civil society space, while you must acknowledge failure and accept failure, and there will always be failure, we have to be careful that that failure doesn't impact other people negatively.
Were there ideas from Nagarik you think would still be useful today?
No, the mission itself for safer roads. India still needs to do a lot more to make our roads safer. And, you know, I haven't stayed up with what all needs to be done. But I'm sorry to say there are not that many organizations who've taken this up as a civil society mission.
So now with all the experience you've learned, you've had, would it not interest you to do Nagarik now?
Once or twice I thought of it, but now I've taken on so many other things that I really don't think I could go back to this particular sector or topic. If there were people, though, doing this work, I would be happy to support them.
You mentioned that perhaps society wasn't ready for it in the way you and your friends were excited about it. It made me think that one of the dangers of people wanting to create change is we often forget to check our own privilege. Can you think of an example where you've had to do that?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing was Nagarik, one of my friends, I'll not name her. She said rather rudely to me, "Why on earth are you doing this? You go by car." I said, "I do go by bus sometimes." She said, "Okay, fine, you go once in a while by bus. But why do you care about any of this? You know, why are you doing all this do-gooding?" And in some sense, it was right. When we do philanthropy or even charity, we have to acknowledge the privileged situation we are in. You have to be very careful when you try to represent the so-called poor or underprivileged or unaccessed or whatever the 100 names people give them, beneficiaries, which I don't like at all. But whoever it is that you claim to do work on behalf of, I think you have to be very careful to listen very deeply first. Is this what they want or is it something you are thrusting upon them?
Did your training as a journalist help you do that?
I think so. My few years as a journalist where you had to listen and talk less, as you are doing now, you had to listen, right? And you had to listen. And as part of your profession, you had to listen to different points of view. And once you start deep listening to people, then also you begin to see where are the gaps that you can help to fill, right? And you have to always be careful that it is not an agenda that we are driving. See, I also want to say sometimes because of the privilege that we are in, we are able to see more people's view than, say, other people can. And perhaps that can be used to an advantage to look ahead to what problems are coming. So, for example, Argyam in the water sector we set up before people had started talking so much about water, right? So I think sometimes the privilege also helps you to see further into the distance because you are listening to so many people.
We had Mridula Ramesh on the show talking about water, and she said that when she started doing all this rainwater harvesting and everything, her privileged family, cousins and all around her, they, much like your other friend who said, "Why are you traveling by car?" They kind of scoffed at her because they felt like, okay, this is just people going overboard with problems that should not affect quote-unquote people like us.
Yeah, but I think the role of empathy comes in. So there is a moral imperative and also a strategic imperative. When you begin to see water as the key resource as it is for everybody's well-being and environmental well-being, systems itself, ecosystems well-being, ecosystems that serve us as human beings, they need sustainable water too. And once you see that as such a key resource for everything, including the economy, then this false binary between the privileged and the unprivileged sort of falls away. And then as in most cases, whether it's the pandemic, whether it's climate change, whether it's water-related crises, you begin to realize that everybody is going to be affected. The poor are going to be affected the most. And the rich, so-called rich or wealthy or privileged, I think also as enlightened self-interest and because it's a moral imperative, should be working on issues like that.
One of the areas that you identified early on, which many people know you from, is Pratham Books. And how did you see reading as an act, as something foundational all those years ago in a country where I feel reading has been increasingly only equated with studying and getting ahead?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And of course, it was the Pratham network, the whole Pratham network that was deeply engaged in the foundational literacy of children all over the country. So I was with the Pratham network before we started Pratham Books. So in the Pratham network, we had all decided that so few books are available for children who had just learned reading through the Pratham network. Something had to be done. And I offered to take on the responsibility of setting up Pratham Books and got two great trustees together, Ashok Kamath and Rekha Menon, and we set it up in Bangalore. And then we just learned by doing. So For me, of course, it was a great passion anyway. I was an early reader. And for me, my childhood was spent between the pages of books. And I wanted every child to experience that joy that I had. And one of the first things we did was, like any good startup, we ourselves started writing. We ourselves started inviting other authors, translators from our networks. And that's how we made the first few books, which were distributed largely through the Pratham network. But then we came on one big idea, and people like Gautam John were very much part of it, that from the beginning, the goal was to democratize the joy of reading. It's not enough to be one publisher or create 15 books a year. It won't do it with 300 million children out there, right? So how do we impact on the world of publishing? How do we just break open everybody's talent in a nation of storytellers? And that's when we decided to put all our content in an open source platform. And I say the rest is history, because tens of millions of children, not only in India, but around the world, have used Pratham Books open platform, now called Storyweaver. After I left, the team made it even more sophisticated and better. So certainly a cause very close to my heart, it remains so, and very necessary to de-link from just being part of the curriculum. We have to learn to read so that we can think. A reading nation is a thinking nation. Reading absolutely diverse things when you're a small child allows you to develop nuances of thinking where you can understand the rich hues between black and white. And so reading for joy and reading to develop yourself as a human being is far more critical, I think. Of course, you need to read at school and pass your tests. But first, reading for yourself when you're 4, 5, and 6.
But do you fear, Rohini, that given the learning losses we've heard about during the shutdown and the pandemic, that the criticality of reading will take a hit, or at least push us back into that whole idea of reading as part of curriculum as opposed to thinking?
In fact, I think the opposite, Sandeep. See, 2 years, children, when they were away from school, what resources did they have? Thanks to Ekstep and thanks to the government's Diksha platform, which Ekstep helped the government to build, the government was able to keep teachers in the game, creating content, able to get children, not just a few children, tens of millions, I would say hundreds of millions of children to connect, unfortunately online, but yes, online, to reading and learning. And what were some of the things and content that was being used? In fact, with several of the state and national institutions, Pratham Books through Storyweaver was able to let children access joyful books through the entire pandemic. So in fact, they were doing non-curriculum reading. And so that itself was an experience for a lot of young parents to have access to non-textbook based reading. And once you like storybooks, nobody can stop you from getting more.
Now, you said one of the game changers here was that you bust open the model by putting everything in open source, Storyweaver, all of that, so everybody could access it. But at the same time, we are told all the time that we don't value things until we put a fair price on them. Like water, for example, with which you work so closely, there's always this argument about that people wouldn't waste water as much as they do if it was priced fairly. So giving books away from free, weren't you worried that people would not value them?
See, books are not like water, right? Now, if you get more water from a finite source, then I will get less. But if books are free, if you read a book, it doesn't mean I will get one less book. So knowledge and finite resources are extremely different in terms of how they are valued, okay? And also once you begin to read, you know, I bet you've read a million books in your life. Once you're hooked to reading, then that's it. You're booked. You're going to keep reading and you're going to find it. And that's why even the entire, if I say so myself, I'm sorry, but the entire children's publishing sector benefited from this. Because once children learn how to read and find joy in reading, they are going to look for more and more books. And many other publishers rode on the back of opening up this market, so to speak, both in English and in many other languages in India.
So when you write another of the Sringeri books that you wrote, is part of it because you want to write more adventures of this character, or is it children clamoring for more stories about them?
It's really both sides, because Sringeri Srinivas sort of drives me. He sort of pops up in my head and says, now what? Now what? So then I have to write something. But I often meet children, parents and teachers and say, when is the next one coming? And then the pressure starts to build. Right now, I'm feeling immense pressure because the last book I wrote was in the pandemic, where Sringeri Srinivas decides to grow his hair almost as a vrat, or a, so that solution to the pandemic will be found. And now that the vaccine is out and his hair has grown from here till there, in these 2 years, I have to find a way to, poor fellow, get him to cut his hair.
Now, this idea that you've explored through the essays and articles in this book about Samaj Sarkar and Bazaar, it's an idea, you say, a colleague of yours expounded. Tell us a little bit about what his theory was about the relationship between these entities.
So Prem Kumar Verma of the Samanta organization in Khagadia in Bihar, when I went there in 2007, was one of our partners at Argyam doing some amazing work in these flood-prone regions. And we were traveling just to see some of the work that we had supported. And while he was telling us many interesting things, one of the things he was saying is also that Samaj feels more shoshit or sort of oppressed now, because earlier Samaj was stronger in some sense and had more distributed power than the state and the market. And maybe he was romanticizing the past, but in some sense it's true that the Sarkar over time, the monarchs of course had a lot of power, but they had limited power in the sense that the whole of society was hardly engaged in what the monarch was doing, except in times perhaps of war. But as government started to acquire more power, more military power, more power to tax and so many things, Samaj took a setback. And the Bazaar in the 300 years post the revolution in India, he was talking more about colonial powers. As the East India Company and then the British government acquired so much power over our society, he felt that Samaj had to take a backseat. And even in the later part of the last century, the state all over the world and the market all over the world through transnational companies, through resource-based companies, acquired tremendous power. And what he said to me made a lot of sense. And then I started to really read up more on this. What have other people been saying about these three sectors? Sometimes civil society is called the third sector, but Samaj as a whole is obviously the foundational first sector for which Bazaar and Sarkar were created, so that Samaj, because it's not a monolith and you will have internal conflicts, you need the state to uphold a rule of law so that we can have a better, more peaceful society. As more and more trade began to happen, exchange began to happen, you needed rules of exchange and you needed a common understanding of value. So the Bazaar kept morphing into the market over the last 300 years. Of course, you need both state and markets. Samaj cannot do without them. But if we flip the notion to see Samaj as the foundational first sector, and all of us, no matter if you have a chief minister or a CEO, we are all Samaj, right? Then how do you reorient all the work that you do or whatever you do as a citizen first is something that began to interest me a lot.
But is the chief minister or that industrialist that interested in flipping this order of things, as it were? I mean, which leads to the question, I mean, where do you see India right now in terms of these three balls being balanced?
Well, I do think, and it's not just India, as I said, but yeah, in India too, the state is very powerful over all our lives. And markets, especially in the last 20, 30 years, the markets are global. I mean, you and I buy from Amazon as much as we buy from Desi companies. And we are very much become consumers of the marketplace from morning till night. Everything we do with our phones and our computers seems to be something that the market is enabling us to do. It's very, very convenient. But if we lose sight of the fact that in this process, actually, we have become data, we are becoming the product. And unless we at least are more aware of this, I think it's a very seductive and slippery slope into becoming consumers first and citizens later. So even if a CEO may have his first priority, maybe to obviously make the profits, take his company into the black and make shareholders very happy, at the end of it, if we uncover our identity layers properly, as a citizen, that same CEO whatever he may be selling in his company, whether it's software services or shoes, when he comes home, who is he? He's a father of children, or he's a spouse, or he's a son, or whatever he is. He's going to care about how his society functions outside his home, right? And that means you want clean air that we can actually breathe, which seems to itself be a problem today. And we want our roads to be working properly. We want schools and colleges to be working properly. We want our counselors or our panchayat leaders or our MLAs to be responsive to what's happening around us. So how can you escape that no matter whether you're making shoes or software services? I think just becoming aware that there's possibly one identity that cuts through all the multiple identity hats that we wear, and that is first as a human being and second as a citizen. That awareness itself, I think, brings some kind of agency to us. It empowers us to get involved in making change in the society that we want to live in.
Yes, because, you know, that is why civil society organizations are created. And as you rightly write in the book, CSOs cannot just be handmaidens of governments. They must be mirrors too. But is that happening? There is a perception that civil society is rapidly being brought under the heels of government and being told to toe the line, and government saying, well, we need to do this because civil society has been too unaccountable.
Governments all over the world and ours too don't seem to like dissent very much. But our civil society is diverse and has many hues. It's not only civil society as dissenters, it's civil society as partners too. So we shouldn't forget that, how important it is for the state to partner with civil society organizations, because the state simply cannot reach the first mile where the citizens are. The government cannot listen well, obviously, to citizens and their first primary woes and things that are emerging. By the time they are emerged, it's too late. Governments have to spend more resources to fix them. So this very critical role of civil society at what we call the first mile, because it's not the last mile, it is the first mile, is very important. And in that process, there will be some dissent if there is some opposition to, say, some law that has been framed or some scheme that has been developed that is leaving some people out, for example. So I think strong governments, secure governments, understand the role of dissent in democracies.
So do we have a secure government?
I hope so, because I hope we are going to have a much more confident and secure government that will look at people who have questions as, in fact, necessary partners in this long path of democracy towards prosperity for all, abundance for all, right?
But do you also think that while we, you know, we use these terms and we samaj, sarkar, bazaar, and we think we know what these terms mean, is there a bit of a disconnect in terms of our understanding of the role that these things really play in society? Because as you said, many of us have gotten seduced into thinking that as part of society, we think ourselves merely as consumers.
Yeah, no, that's why this book, right? That's why much of my writing, that's why much of my work. I truly believe this conversation has to be on the table at all times. And this conversation is never going to end if we do say 10 things, that's it, we are done. Because to be a citizen, unfortunately, is a lifetime role. Now, you can do citizenship at many levels. Some people will be fully involved day and night. And some people will say we want to just pay our taxes and obey the law. But even those will find themselves involved in local issues more and more. Because especially as India is growing so fast, and especially in its urban areas, you as a citizen every day going out of your home are going to encounter civic problems and issues. And therefore, more and more people are wanting to be part of the new association, social association groups that are forming, like the residential welfare associations and many like those. It's very hard for an individual. How am I going to fix the system? How many times am I going to call the government on the helpline? If a few of us came together, we have more creativity, we have more energy, and we have more voice. So I think more and more people are trying to be part of some association, however hyper-local. And thanks to digital now, it could even be global. So citizenship is acquiring new energy is what I feel. And I feel that discussion and that conversation is very, very important. precisely because the Sarkar and Bazaar everywhere are acquiring so much power, and power acquires power. So unless all of us as citizens learn to find new ways to act collectively, it's not always about fighting. We don't always have to fight. It's about conversations, cooperation, collective action, working together to solve common problems in a creative way.
To try and communicate these ideas about what the role of the citizen should be when your husband was running for political office. I mean, was there interest in this conversation?
I did to some extent. My job was really to represent Nandan, right? So it was not about what Rohini thinks in those hectic months. I was trying to say what the candidate wants to do for you or what are his ideas for your welfare. They all wanted their problems solved by the MP. Problems as simple as fixing their roads and their drains and their water connections, which are very things very worthy and necessary to be fixed, but not by your MP, because there's no way the MP can do that. At least not in the way his role is described in the constitution. And the campaign is so hectic, you don't get to sit down and have very deep conversations on the constitutional framework. But they're saying, I don't care, you better listen to me. And I listened very deeply. People were so frustrated that these simple things were not getting solved. So when somebody came to ask for their vote, they say, you better listen to what I need. And that's what they needed. But I thought the path they were taking was not going to anywhere get to them to solve their problem. So one MP may solve one pipe because he knows somebody or she knows somebody, but that's not going to solve the systemic problem anyway. So then I started writing and talking about, I wish we would hold our MPs and MLAs more accountable to be better lawmakers and policymakers, so that that policy can enable the executive to do what it needs to do, which is to fix those things that those people wanted, the water, the electricity, the roads, and the schools and the hospitals and the all those kinds of basic public infra that they desperately needed, right? But if we focused on that, because I really have written in the book and do believe that good laws make for a good society, and if we held our elected representatives accountable to framing good laws, and then they could hold the executive accountable for upholding those good laws, I think the voters would have less problems than they do now.
It didn't make you want to run for office?
No, it made me want to run away from office. Just because it is so difficult, you know, and just it's so hard to be a politician everywhere, I suppose, but in India, definitely, precisely because of all these expectations. You are expected 24/7 to be there for the people. There are groups and subgroups and sub-interests and vested interests and all kinds of things that you have to juggle and balance. Hats off to those politicians who do it well and keep getting re-elected. It's a very tough job.
Is there a project that you've worked on where you feel like these stakeholders of Samaj, Bazaar and Sarkar have actually come together in a way where it worked and they were not stepping on each other's toes?
So in a very small way, it came together at Pratham Books, very small way. Now, children's books is a very easy thing. It's not politically dangerous or contested. So yeah, in Pratham Books, Samaj, Bazaar, Sarkar came together. Even the Bazaar got involved because many of our books were also sold in the marketplace. I think at 8th step, we have tried by working first with the government to set up for them the whole Diksha platform, and then working very actively with the NGO communities to get them also to offer value-added services in addition to what they're already doing in the field of education, and market players like tuition agencies and, you know, all the for-profit education companies, the edtech companies, getting them also involved. And then in Nandan's work in financial services also, some of that is coming together. We tried in water, but that's really much more difficult to get the Bazaar into the water space in any meaningful way at scale, given the current policy framework in the country. But the pandemic showed all of us, no? What Samaj, Sarkar, Bazaar can do together, it is quite remarkable. And I don't want to discount the death and despair that we all experienced. But just think how much in human history, in just 2 years, okay, how much visible and invisible cooperation between Samaj, Sarkar and Bazaar happened, and how fast, how quickly Samaj institutions were the first responders, just humans were the first responders to neighbors, to people on the street. And then, of course, the Sarkar moved in as fast as it could in the way it knew how to. That's how the Sarkar knew how to do it then. And how quickly the bazaar moved in. Not in India, thank heavens, the Serum Institute, but others as well. And globally to create the vaccine in the shortest ever time in human history, right? And how much people supported the rapid change that the Sarkar created and the bazaar enabled.
Do you think that will have a lasting effect? I mean, one of the cons of it is during the pandemic, many governments, and I'm not just talking about, suddenly went for a more centralized approach. They said, okay, you know, all of this has to be laid aside, all power, all decision making has to come from here. And after the pandemic, we heard things about like, okay, the bazaar needs to catch up. So child labor laws must be loosened in some states. You know, there was discussion about that. But do you think the changes, the positive changes that you're talking about from those 2 years will last?
That's the point, right? That we can never take freedoms for granted. No society can take freedoms for granted, right? And in the pandemic, yes, some powers began to coalesce, right? We willingly gave up some of our freedoms during the pandemic because we understood that the individual good for some time had to be subsumed under the public good, right? Or the common good. I had to wear a mask and cover my mouth and nose, not just for myself, but for you and her and him. And we did that willingly. And some power started accumulating because power is like that. And that's why you need the Samaj to be strong, aware, and have its leadership and its institutions always ready. Because you can't keep giving up power. You have to take it back when the crisis is over. That power has to come back to the Samaj. And this requires the Samaj to be active. One of my mentors used to say, a stick is never given away. And you don't obviously want what happens in times of crisis to become the norm. But to talk of the positive things that happen, I think some new forms of trust capital were built during the pandemic, right? Because state had to work, local state representatives were happy to work with civil society. The bazaar and government worked very closely together. So some, you know, mistrust fell away and new forms of trust capital were built. It is now our job as citizens and Samaj to build more of, to now enrich the trust capital so that the next time and to actually build solid processes based on that new trust capital. So the next time the crisis comes, as it will, in some form or the other, we can respond faster because we have now invested in the non-crisis time to build more bridges across the sectors. Because when the three work together, we ourselves have seen just so recently what can happen. And it must happen again and again. And that work has to be done now. And I think the onus is on us, the Samaj, to reduce mistrust and to constantly try to find ways to build social capital of trust.
So we'll have to leave it there. Rohini Nilekani, thank you so much for joining us and talking about your book with us.
Thank you, Sandeep. That was wonderful of you to listen so patiently. Dhanyavaad and namaskar.
Rohini Nilekani has been associated with several civil society movements such as Pratham Books, Argyam and Ek Step Foundation. Her book, Samaj Sarkar Bazaar, A Citizen's First Approach, is available freely for readers to download and share. Share your feedback on our show on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram at Express Podcasts. We do our best to be listeners first. This show was produced by Shashank Bhargav and edited and mixed by Suresh Pawar. Thanks for listening. This is Sandeep Roy on Express Audio.